The opposite of austerity in Japan today. From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The Japanese government today approved a package of measures to add money and therefore juice to the perennially limp economy there. If you count new spending, the stimulus is worth $45 billion. But you'll see valuations of this running six times higher than that if it's measured over many years. Some market participants think this was too small and Japan's Nikkei stock index fell 1.5% today. But it sure looks like big stimulus. To get some context, let's turn to Seijiro Takeshita, a professor at the School of Management and Information, University of Shizuoka.
Well, I think there's a very clear mismatch between those people who basically says that this is a disappointment, which is looking at short-term or medium-term type of issues, for example, like GDP growth, et cetera, versus what the government is aiming for, which is now transferred into much more transitional type of long-term structural growth, which basically takes a very, very long time to solve. Whereas the market expectation is looking at a lot more short-terminism, for example, market reactions that you can see in stock market, for example.
Give me a sense of when you say structural, like what?
It's very clear that we'll be in shortage of labor even as we speak. We have the highest level of job offer to applicant ratio in 23 years, partly because, well, we have lesser young people and our birth rate is very, very low, lower than that of Germany. So we have a problem here. We need to supplement the labor, and that's one of the reasons why government is trying to open up labor to women, which Japan is very much behind, and also to immigration policies, etc. But unfortunately, we have a lot of structural issues, for example, child care issues. Our companies and our structures are still very much behind in that sense, still sticking to the old 70s, 80s type of growth-oriented type of organizations, which basically, in my opinion, robs away a lot of opportunities ahead of us.
Seijiro Takeshita is professor at the School of Management and Information, University of Shizuoka in Japan. Professor, thank you for this briefing.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Now let's check some other markets. London's FTSE is down 0.4%. Dow and NASDAQ futures are down about 0.1%, 15 points on the Dow future. Oil, after a sharply down week, is up 1.3% and back above $40 a barrel in New York right now. The Dollar Shave Club, a company that started with a clever viral video, recently sold for $1 billion, not through an initial public offering in which a company sells stock to the public. It was sold to another much bigger company, the consumer products giant Unilever. It has not been a boom year for these IPOs. Last year, there were 234, according to one tally. This year, so far, just 71. Gigi Duban explains why.
IPOs are going the way of acid wash jeans. Big in the 90s, not so much now. Jay Ritter teaches finance at the University of Florida. He says instead of going public, more companies are selling out.
The bigger company can apply the best technology and produce things efficiently and sell products to consumers at lower prices.
And the smaller guys avoid the hassles of being public. Jerry Davis is author of the book The Vanishing American Corporation.
If you want to go public, you're going to face a lot of demands that take you away from what you think the business is all about.
Like disclosing CEO salaries and keeping investors happy. But companies once had no choice.
Companies went public because they needed money to build factories or to buy railroad tracks or to set up stores across the country.
Now that companies can rent just about anything, equipment, workers, Davis says for many, going public isn't worth the headache. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
There's news. McDonald's is revamping its ingredients in a move away from artificial preservatives and high fructose corn syrup. The president of McDonald's U.S. operation says the changes will affect half the menu, including chicken McNuggets and burger buns. He says consumers are pushing for this. Now to genetically modified crops. 2 years ago, McDonald's said it doesn't use genetically engineered potatoes. And some big food processors are saying they're moving away from sugar derived from sugar beets grown from genetically modified seeds. Sugar beet growers are struggling to understand consumer objections, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Farmer Bill Hale will never forget a conversation he had the first year he grew genetically modified sugar beets. It was around harvest time, and he was chatting with a fellow farmer in the Red River Valley of North Dakota, where they live. It's a hotspot for sugar beet production.
He said, "So, Bill, how do you like Roundup sugar beets?" And his name is Dave. I said, "Dave, I'll tell you, today is the second time I've been in this field in a tractor this year." And Dave said, "Oh," just like that.
Hill spent so much less time in his tractor because the new seeds made weed control a lot easier. They're engineered to resist the herbicide Roundup, which kills a lot more weeds than the old herbicides did. Hill takes me out into one of his fields and points to a pile of big weeds.
Well, these dead weeds are what you can get with biotechnology. With the old conventional herbicide, you never would kill a weed that size.
Hill says compared to conventional sugar beets, the genetically modified ones require fewer herbicide applications and they reduce its carbon footprint. So he's surprised consumers object to them. Scientists say GMOs are safe, but some consumers think they need more testing. That's prompted a few big food companies like Hershey's to move towards non-GMO cane sugar.
We seem to be on the tip of the arrow because we have this situation where you have cane over here and you have sugar beets on this side. There's an option.
Dan Youngren and I are standing in one of his sugar beet fields in Minnesota, getting a bit soaked by rain. As is the case for Bill Hale, Youngren grows other crops too, but sugar beets are the most profitable for him. The co-op the two farmers belong to, American Crystal Sugar, says so far non-GMO fears are not pushing business down. But the co-op is nevertheless exploring what it would take to return to conventional non-GMO beets. Dan Youngren thinks just finding the old herbicides would be tough.
There's nobody that's producing the chemical to spray on a conventional style beet.
But the really big barrier, he says, would be getting everyone in the co-op to agree they should sell non-GMO sugar beets.
Either everybody's in or everybody's out, and I know everybody wants to stay in where we're at.
In the Red River Valley, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Oh, I love Midwesterners. A bit soaked. Our producers are Justin Ho, Katie Long, and Christopher Olin. Our engineer this week is Jake Gorski. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.